You are listening to CEO Perspectives, a podcast by the Conference Board.
Welcome to this episode of CEO Perspectives, a signature series by the Conference Board. CEO Perspectives are conversations that take an objective, nonpartisan look at a range of timely topics that matter most to business leaders. To help make sense of these topics and how they'll unfold, we'll sit down with thought leaders and do what we do best at the Conference Board, provide trusted insights for what's ahead. I'm Steve Auden, the CEO of the Conference Board and the host of this series. And in today's conversation, we're going to discuss the results of the U.S. midterm elections, how a split Congress will impact policy, and what this means for the 2024 elections. Joining me today is Dr. Lori Esposito-Murray, the president of the Committee for Economic Development, which is the public policy center of the Conference Board. Lori, welcome.
Thanks, Steve. Very pleased to be here with you.
So, Lori, all right, finally, it's over. I mean, it's been 2 years of this leading to the midterm elections. How are these results compared to what was predicted pre-election? And what are the implications of all that?
So, Steve, as has been widely reported from before the election and through today, the red wave was expected. And the red wave was expected by the Republicans. And part of the reasons why they thought that was because of the inflation, the economy in crisis. That was the top issue that was most important to Americans. I would say that it was really just looking at the situation we're in economically compared to where we have been in the past, that this was seen as a real turning point for the Republican Party in terms of leadership in the House and in the Senate. What happened, though, was that the country went to vote, and they voted, which is really encouraging, in large numbers for a midterm election. And they voted exactly where we are, which is we are divided. We're a divided country. They brought back to the House and to the Senate basically those very, very close margins that we've been dealing with, an extreme disappointment to the Republicans, given that they thought in a midterm election, especially that first midterm election in a presidential first term, they usually, the opposition party usually wins. But nonetheless, it reflected where we are as a nation. One significant difference is, of course, and it is meaningful, is that the leadership of the House has changed hands from Democrats to Republicans.
But Lori, going into this, the polls were all said that, 75% of Americans are not happy with the direction of the country. And that's consistent among Democrats and Republicans for different reasons, by the way. So this is really not a big change. I mean, it is a change in leadership of the House, but it's just a few seats. But it's not this massive change that you would guess would happen with 75% of the people unhappy.
Well, if you actually dive a little deep into the numbers, Steve, and this is really important to remember, and CED, the Committee for Economic Development, which is Public Policy Center of the Conference Board, has been working on this for years, including when you were head of the Committee for Economic Development, and that's the gerrymandering. Only 1/6 of the 435 House seats are actually competitive. And so that's about 70 seats. So you're really dealing with a much smaller number. And I think what you saw happened was that even though the current president had low favorability numbers, the former president had low favorability numbers, people went to the polls and they made their decision to vote in these small turnover elections that were actually competitive. And they made those decisions to vote really looking at their local candidates, looking for the more moderate candidate. I think that's one of the big takeaways from what came out of this election, is that Americans were looking for more moderate candidates.
Yeah, which is really interesting. You know, you mentioned gerrymandering, which is the redrawing of these district lines. And that only 1/6 are competitive seats. What I think what you mean by that is that essentially they're either safe for the Democrat or safe for the Republican. And so all the action then is in the primaries, right?
Right. And in terms of lessons learned, I think the Republicans really need to look nationally at why their expectations were so high and where they went, you know, why it turned away from their expectations and we remained divided. And the need to look at what their messaging was, who their candidates were. For the Democrats, what's really interesting, I think they need to look, if you're looking towards 2024, they really need to look at Florida and they need to look at New York. Those were two states where the Republicans had very, very significant wins. And New York, what's interesting about New York, I believe, is that that state was actually the districts that were carved out by the Democrats. Democratic legislature was actually challenged in the courts, and those were court designed. And the Democrats went from 19 to 8 seats for Republicans to 15 seats to 11 for Republicans. And those were districts that were designed by a court-appointed specialist in order to try and create more fair districts. So I think New York is a very interesting lesson, lessons to be learned for the Democrats. And in terms of Florida, I think this election basically didn't decide anything nationally. We are where we have been. I think Florida was very decisive. It was an election that was a decisive election with significant Republican wins, and the way Floridians voted was determinant in terms of clearly a win for the Republican Party. And so there are lessons learned there for both parties, obviously, but for the Democrats, I think that's really significant in a state that had always been considered a swing state.
Yeah, so there was a red wave in Florida, but that's about the only place. Go back to what you were saying about, I didn't quite catch the numbers in New York. So having redrawn the districts, we went from how many Republican seats to how many?
So Democrats had 19 seats, Republicans had 8 in this current, current Congress. In the new Congress, the Democrats will have 15. So 19 to 15, Republicans went from 8 to 11.
Okay. And so basically what you're saying is with some objectivity of redrawing the districts, it shifted 4 or 5 seats essentially. So meaning that it was a little more biased before.
Right. And so that's why I think it's an important test case, because you have New York redrawn by a court appointed specialist to correct what they thought were biases in the redistricting that was done by the Democratic legislature. So trying to get a more fair approach. And in fact, Republicans took more seats.
Yeah. Okay. So let's look at the Senate for a minute, because the Senate Senate's not over in the Senate, because we still have this Georgia seat, but the Democrats have picked up one seat, thereby assuring that they have control of the Senate. So is the conclusion here nothing changes as it relates to the Senate and how the Senate is performing and interacting with the White House?
Nothing changes as far as the Senate performing. I think the House going Republican, which I know you will get to, actually changes the dynamic for Congress. But in terms of the Senate, I would say, though, that what you're going to see on the Republican side, and you've seen this in the vote for minority leader for Senator McConnell, is that there's more concern and disruption within the Republican Party because of the results of the election. And so there's a lot of questioning going on from all different sides in terms of why the Republicans ended up where they ended up.
But from a Senate standpoint, you know, the key tasks of the Senate that they can do independently, you know, relate to the judiciary, right?
Right, judiciary, cabinet appointments, appointments in general, and the ambassadorships throughout the political appointees throughout the government. Yes, so that will stay in Democratic control, which is significant for the president and his leadership and his ability to basically staff his administration the way he would like to.
So that should continue, and there's something, 150 or so judgeships open, and so the Senate here can go ahead and fill those consistent with the appointees wanted by the White House. And should a Supreme Court justice open up, that's a materially significant situation.
And but remember, the minority does have power. A lot of those seats haven't been, a lot of the nominations haven't been filled yet for the administration on the lower levels. So there, you know, the Republicans will have power in terms of disruption or delay. But exactly to your point, when it comes in, particularly when it comes to a Supreme Court decision, if a seat should open up and become vacant in the Supreme Court, that it is significant that the Democrats have maintained power and control on those very, very important issues.
Okay, so let's shift over to the House. So previously, the House was in control of the Democrats as well. So the Democrats had the White House and both houses of Congress. Now it's split. The Republicans will control it, but it's a very small number of seats. It's not over yet. There are a lot still to be called, but it's apparent that it's going to be, you know, a relatively small number of seats. What are the ramifications of that?
Well, first of all, let's put it in historical perspective. Since World War II, very few presidents have actually led unified governments. I think it's about 16 years of the past 52 years have actually been unified governments. And those were, Jimmy Carter had it for his entire four-year term. Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, and President Biden have had it for only 2 years. And of the Republicans, only President Bush and President Trump had a unified Congress for portions of their term. So keep in mind, having a split Congress is something that has been how we've governed for most of the past 52 years. So with that in mind, the margin in the House is small. This is significant for a number of reasons, and it requires leadership. It will require very skilled leadership on the part of the next speaker. And obviously, Congressman McCarthy is the majority leader, is actually running for that post. In order to get that post, he needs 218 votes on the floor of the House of those members present. And so that requires a lot of negotiation, a lot of bargaining. And so, and also keep in mind, in 2015, McCarthy lost speakership because the conservatives wouldn't support him. So what you're going to see is over the next weeks and months, couple of months more before the vote for the speaker, is a lot of bargaining going on, which will actually give a window into the type of flexibility that McCarthy will have if he becomes speaker, or whomever becomes speaker, in terms of how they govern within their party. How much attention do they have to pay to the Freedom Caucus versus their other members?
Yeah, and you know, the Republican Party is not a monolith. It's sort of like an association of a bunch of caucuses that not really liking each other and not being consistent necessarily in policy. It seems like the Democrats are more of a monolith in how they operate and everything. So that brings challenges to McCarthy should he be elected here as Speaker in January. Where do you think he goes in terms of his priorities then?
Well, and that's what's really significant. How will those priorities shape out? We're already seeing some of this just in the past 24 or 48 hours. One of the things that has come out loud and clear, which is not a surprise, but the intensity of it is, I think, a surprise, is the level of investigations and how many investigations the House Republican leadership of committees are committing to. And the press conference that was held yesterday, it's pretty broad sweeping. It's investigations of the judiciary, of the...
Well, there's a Hunter Biden thing.
The Hunter Biden, you could just go down the list, even talking about impeaching the president. So it looks like those type of investigations are going to happen. They're going to take time. They're going to take attention. And so what happens to the policy piece of the agenda? And here you've had McCarthy actually talk about what his commitment to America is. That's how he's framed it. He's talked about the importance of the border. He's talked about the importance of tackling inflation. And that means he's defined that as looking for spending cuts in terms of the size of the government and what we actually, what our budgets look like. Debt deficits become important. So he's laid out And he said he wouldn't deal with the immigration issue until the border issue was dealt with. So he's laying out some of his priorities already. And of course, crime and looking at the rising crime issues and funding the police, and also looking at or the rules of putting people in jail and when they get out are also on his agenda.
We're discussing the results from the midterm elections and how a split Congress will impact legislation moving forward. We're going to take a short break and we'll be right back.
As you and your company monitor the latest wave of shocks that have battered the U.S. economy, the award-winning forecast team at the Conference Board now predicts a recession by the end of 2022. This recession will further compound the crises that have recently upended original expectations, from a deadly pandemic to a war in Ukraine and the highest inflation in decades. Yet, unprecedented crises also present unforeseen opportunities if you have a trusted, proven navigator by your side. With that in mind, and as the Conference Board has always done, we are providing you with daily, timely, and relevant content that will guide the business community through the economic storm. These trusted insights are being gathered on our website and are available to help your company master the challenges ahead. Visit us at conference-board.org/topics/recession. Then, on November 29th, join us for a live virtual briefing from our economists and other financial experts. It's complimentary to you and your colleagues. Register now on our website to hear the latest on weathering this economic turbulence.
Welcome back to CEO Perspectives. I'm your host, Steve Odlin, and I'm joined today by Dr. Lori Esposito-Murray, the president of the Committee for Economic Development, which is the public policy center of the Conference Board. Okay, so Lori, before the break, we were talking about what Leader McCarthy's and potentially Speaker McCarthy's priority is going to be. But unilaterally, the Republicans in the House can do very little. I mean, they can do their investigations all day long. Maybe it's cathartic. There's some political payback, and so, but that's not really moving the policy agenda. In order to move anything, they have to work with the Senate and obviously the White House. Is there any common ground on policy today?
So I think there are a number of issues where there is potentially common ground. One is actually having to fund the government. So we have to do the appropriations bills. We have to fund defense. We have to fund the farm bill. We have to reauthorize the federal aviation, the FAA authority. There's also what we've seen the past 2 years have been incredible progress coming out of Congress, even though the overall image is of a do-nothing, can't-do-anything split Congress. The legislation that has gone through, or the amount of legislation that has gone through, is actually historic. And I think what's key there, Steve, is that the reason why I believe it's been historic is because the nation has been in crisis, first with the pandemic, and then following that, the Russian invasion of Ukraine has led to, just as we thought we were coming out of the economic crisis and the health crisis of the pandemic, on the economic side, we were supposed to be coming out of the pandemic, and instead, it was that recovery has been pushed back by the supply chain issues, the energy issues, all the disruption that the invasion of Ukraine has done, never mind how it's reordering global politics. So there are issues that I think, because of crisis, Congress will actually find issues to come together on. That's particularly on the funding side to get those bills through. But there are also the issues of R&D. There's a lot of support looking back over the past 2 years on both sides of the aisle for increased spending on research and development so that we keep our technological edge. There's commonality on China. We saw that in a number of pieces of legislation, including the CHIPS Act. Trade issues, moving from globalization to onshoring and nearshoring and friendshoring, is issues that are widely shared. Of course, Iran, North Korea, cybersecurity issues, and as I had mentioned, the farm bill. So there are a number of areas where Congress can actually and probably will be working together. A number of them are just the important keep the wheels of government going in terms of appropriations bills and spending funding. But then there are these national security issues as well.
Yeah, but you know, you described the last 2 years as historic, but I think when I listen to you, it sounds like the historic nature of it has been the amount of spending. I mean, we're over 100% debt to GDP now, and it's all been debt. And it sounds like the potential to work together is to spend more and go further into debt if we work together. And you know, both parties are good at that. But it doesn't sound like, I don't hear you saying anything that will help us fix the level of debt or the, you know, the economic situation here.
Well, so to that point, I should have mentioned, of course, infrastructure, you know, where there was incredible bipartisan agreement, a very strong bipartisan agreement. And some of those bills, as you pointed out, and some of the large bills, the $1.9 billion funding of COVID aid in the first few months of the Biden administration, you know, strictly Democratic support. So some were bipartisan, some were strictly Democrats, and a tremendous amount of spending, as you said. That is on McCarthy's agenda. He wants to cut spending and he wants to deal with the debt and deficit. And what's interesting here is that I actually think there's more bipartisan attention being brought to the debt deficit issues because of inflation. And so as inflation goes up, as our debt is rolled over, it's going to be rolled over at higher rates. So this is something that will kick in over a couple of years, but there is attention being paid and recognition, I think, on both sides of the aisle as to the fact that the inflation is going to increase the servicing of our debt, which decreases the amount of funding available for programs.
Yeah, but you know, there just seems not to be any kind of appetite for solving the debt situation until the national crisis is created, and then of course they'll do something. But it's just so sad that they can't deal with this, you know, in advance. Everybody knows this is coming. Let's turn to, you know, let's go back to, you know, you mentioned foreign policy, and you are a globally recognized foreign policy expert in addition to being a domestic policy expert. But, you know, this is, you still have a lot of these geopolitical situations going on. Obviously, a war in Ukraine, you had a missile coming from somewhere that lands in Poland and others in Moldova, which, you know, does, you know, question whether, you know, it would spark a NATO intrusion. You've got the Chinese-Taiwan situation. You've got Iran, you know, selling drones everywhere. So there's a lot of stuff going on here. One thing that we have been able to demonstrate bipartisanship on is when, you know, people come at us, we tend to then set aside our internal politics and band together. What do you see, you know, in the next 2 years, what do you see coming, bubbling to the top here and that potentially could, you know, to take their attention away from all this domestic stuff and really bring them together from a foreign policy perspective?
Well, I think in terms of what could happen, it really is a dangerous and very wide open possibilities where nuclear weapons can be used. That is a real possibility. And I think it's becoming more probable as Putin gets more and more squeezed and humiliated or embarrassed in Ukraine. And whether it's nuclear weapons or an escalation to chemical weapons, we have to be prepared for that. And we have to be prepared for that use. And we have to be prepared for how we react. I think there is more understanding of that in Congress than there probably is in the business community or at the nation at large. Because they stay, obviously have oversight over the intelligence community and reporting. So that is I guess it's not a black swan. I think at the conference board, we call it gray swans, where you know that this is a possibility that may happen. And that the escalation of the war in Ukraine involving NATO, escalating in terms of the types of weapon use is a real, real concern and a real probability we have to be prepared for. The China and Taiwan. That has to be on the national agenda and is on the national agenda as an area that we need to watch very closely and be planning for a more aggressive behavior by China in Taiwan. Whether it happens or not is actually, you know, we're with both of these situations where we're watching very closely what Xi Jinping does in China and what Putin does in Russia. And it's the decisions of whether to, on their part, to move forward in a more aggressive and dangerous manner. We can play a role in with deterrence, with warnings as to what our reaction would be. But you know, for the most part, we better be prepared for action that they may take. And so that brings leadership together. It has to bring leadership together. And we also have, of course, the public health issues. We don't know where COVID is going in terms of how it may change in terms of the types of viruses that will evolve.
Well, let's go back to Taiwan. If China takes military action in Taiwan, will the Democrats and Republicans come together to take action, military action against that to support Taiwan?
So that is really hard to say definitively now without that happening. There, the reason why I'm hesitating, Steve, because it's obviously something that the president has said that he would take military action to respond to Taiwan, which was a step forward in terms of U.S. policy on Taiwan. And then, of course, you know, that was pulled back a little bit to clarify. But the what's interesting is that, you know, you're dealing with Congress. And so Congress is very responsive to the American public's reaction. And so one of the concerns that you that members of Congress have on any issue, particularly an issue of committing U.S. forces, is providing the leadership if it has to be done. And if the American public isn't on board immediately, providing that leadership to explain why it needs to be done, but weighing where the American public is, because they are representative of the American public, is extremely important and part of the calculation that any member of Congress has to take into account. But of course, they also have to take into account U.S. national security.
Yeah, but it has to start with the administration, and the administration needs to take a decision and take the lead on saying we need to do this, we're going to do it, and then Congress has to fall in line. Congress can't unilaterally act on that, right?
Right, but it is in terms of going to war and committing U.S. troops, it's obviously the president and the administration has the lead, but it's also needs the support of Congress.
Okay, so last subject, what does all this mean? You know, the results of these midterm elections. What does this tell you about 2024? Donald Trump has already announced his campaign. That doesn't seem to have been met with great enthusiasm in any corner. You know, President Biden has made a lot of noise that he's going to run again. And you have a lot of people on both parties saying, gee, can't we just pass the torch here to the next generation? What do you think these results tell the two parties?
Well, first, in terms of 2024, we are already in the 2024 election, as you've indicated. It started even before the results of the election are fully known, of this midterm election. And so it's 2024. And that will guide everything that happens in Congress in terms of the president and his policies. That is the guidepost. That's the North Star on what happens. And in terms of the Republican reaction on the Hill and the Republican leadership on the Hill. So it's 2024. On the other hand, the next year, I think, is really significant in terms of the President Biden's decision on whether to run. And I think he will make that decision into this year as he begins to weigh his effectiveness, his ability to make change, how Democrats are feeling, the Democratic Party is feeling about his ability to win, and also looking at the Republicans' the strategy in terms of where they're heading. And they're, you know, they're on the Republican side, it's actually really fascinating because the Florida win has elevated, obviously, Governor DeSantis's profile in the Republican Party and in terms of the presidential leadership and where the Republican Party goes. And it's also, which, you know, that was the obvious coming out of the election. But what's also interesting is that has also freed a number of other very interested future potential presidential candidates on the Republican side to distance themselves from President Trump with his reelection announcement. And, you know, you're seeing a number, you know, whether it's Mike Pence or Pompeo, you know, a number of Republican potentials actually seeing that the field might be open after the results of the midterm elections. So on the Democrats.
So if the two nominees are Joe Biden and Donald Trump again in 2024, who wins?
Well, I think if Donald Trump is the nominee for the Republican Party, I think that actually helps President Biden in terms of how he's perceived as the person who had beat Donald Trump once, and he should be the candidate to beat Donald Trump again. So I think that Donald Trump actually helps President Biden in terms of if he is going to run again, in terms of the support for him running again. And then you asked who would win if they actually are.
You just said Biden. I heard it.
Yeah, well, I think.
You announced it here first.
And so here's what I would point to, and that was the start of our conversation. So where did the American, what's the big takeaway from this midterm election? And I think it's actually the takeaway from a couple of the previous elections as well, is where is the American public? And the American public is actually much more moderate. The votes that actually determine how an election go in those races that are competitive. The voters tend to be more moderating than on the extremes. And, you know, I think that's really fascinating. I think that's really encouraging about our democracy. It shows that, you know, there is flexibility. We seem to look at these political debates as being so polarized. And actually, I think the American public is pretty thoughtful about what they do.
Dr. Laurie Esposito-Murray, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Steve.
And thanks to all of you for listening in to CEO Perspectives. Every week, I'll be joined by prominent thought leaders to provide insights on the issues of our time. We'll cover leading topics in economics, geopolitics, public policy, ESG, human capital, and more. Please share CEO Perspectives with your colleagues, your friends, your families, all of your political, you know, everybody. I'm Steve Odland, and this series has been brought to you by the Conference Board.
You've been listening to a podcast from the Conference Board, the indispensable ally that has helped businesses through war, recession, and economic transformation since our founding in 1916. As recent unexpected economic challenges persist, you can find the latest and most trusted insights for what's ahead on our website. Please join us on November 29th for a live global virtual briefing from our award-winning economists and other financial experts. Get the latest thinking in how to best weather the economic turbulence by registering for this free briefing at conference-board.org/topics/recession.